Some crimes are never forgotten, others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the necessary shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor, and I'm joined by my partner in all endeavors strategic, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C., and the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Elliot, welcome.
Well, thanks. It's good to be here. I'm looking forward to a discussion of a very good book by a very good historian about somebody that I like less than I think either of you guys like, but we'll go into that.
Well, let's get into that because our guest is James Graham Wilson, historian in the Department of State's Office of the Historian, and author of a brand new book published by Cornell University Press, America's Cold Warrior, Paul Nitze, National Security and National Security from Roosevelt to Reagan. And also, by the way, Paul Nitze being the eponymous sponsor of the school where you professed for some 30 plus years, and where I in a much lower rank did for about 14 years. James, we're glad to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. Both of you have been so kind and encouraging to me over the years. And I'm obliged to say that these views are my own and not those of the Department of State. But I, you know, just happy to launch into it, to talk about anything about this book, how I came to it, what I think the major themes are, whatever you think I should say first.
All right. Well, first, I don't think that Elliot and I need any disclaimers. We definitely do not speak for the Department of State or any other element of the U.S. government. Nitze is a fascinating character. You know, I observed him, not from very close up, but from reasonably close at the end of the middle and end of the Reagan administrations. He, in some ways, as you suggest in the book, is the sort of first national security professional in the post-war era. Tell us a little bit about how you came to write about Nitze, but also talk a little bit about how he began this trajectory as a national security professional, essentially during World War II.
Yeah, so two things. The first one, in terms of the origins of my interest in the book, I was at a Wilson Center event about 10 years ago, where there was a wonderful scholar who's, I think, a mutual friend of ours, Frank Castigliola, who at the time was editing the George Kennan diaries and then working on a biography of George Kennan. And as he's speaking and sort of going through what Kennan said or what Kennan thought at different phases of the Cold War, whether it's Vietnam or in the mid-1980s when, Eric, you were working for George Shultz, I kept thinking to myself, well, he's saying these things, he's writing these things, and nobody's actually listening to him in terms of the people who are having to grapple with these matters. I mean, he kind of dismisses the Euro missiles debate because it's not important to him. Well, it's important to the people at the time in areas of government. And at each moment, I thought, well, you know, Kennan is not really the emblematic Cold Warrior. At each of these moments, there is somebody who's either in government working on these issues or is out of government and whose voice is shaping debates internally and commanding White House attention, and that's Paul Nitze. And I went to dinner with Frank afterwards, and I sort of went through it, how I thought that, you know, Kennan is important up to 1950, but then he sort of takes himself out of the equation. And we think he's important because he's such a wonderful writer, and he expresses regret about the trajectory of foreign policy that follows his departure, which is easy to do. You know, it's easy for anyone to say, well, everything fell apart after I left. And, you know, Frank...
All of us in government do that.
Yeah. But I mean, Frank being a wonderful mentor said, well, you should pursue this. You know, if that's what you believe, you should dig into this question. And so I did, not as quickly as I should have, but I had, you know, some wonderful assistance over the years. And David Milne has written a wonderful chapter about Nitze in his own book. And I found also at the Library of Congress these series of thousands of pages of interviews that Paul Nitze did first with the Air Force, and then in preparation of his own memoir, you know, throughout the 1980s, where he really gave, I think, insightful answers, not necessarily the correct kind of, I mean, he was talking about things from 50 years earlier, so he's not always getting things exactly accurate. And of course, he remembers things in a certain way he wants to remember them. But I found that to be a tremendous goldmine of material. And then, you know, I think, as with many of us, at the outbreak of the pandemic, we were kind of stuck with something we needed to do. And I'll just, you know, close out this part of the origin story by saying that I think it was around March 2020 that I remember reading, there's something called H. Diplo, which some of your listeners may know, a wonderful kind of email listserv for people who are interested in these matters. And they have a sub-series, which is scholars reflecting on their careers and what got them motivated. And there was a wonderful one that happened to come out right at the start of the pandemic by John Lewis Gaddis, who sort of talked about just the role of how much, from my takeaway, was it sort of how much writing shaped his life, you know, just how he lived. And here I was somewhat daunted by his massive biography of Kennan, which took him 25 or 30 years. But I also thought, look, you know, you've just got to write. You've got, this is something that is hard. It's something, but it's something that sustains us. And this is kind of, I need to do this. And I did it. So I did it. And, you know, my wife and I were pregnant at the time. And one of the saving graces of being up all night was I needed something to distract myself. And so I would often find myself trying to think through questions from about Nitze in the 50s and 60s and in my own mind, you know, how to grapple with them. So the second part of the question, or the second question you ask, is, you know, say more about Nitze and the field of national security. I'm always struck now, you know, if you look on LinkedIn, you will see there are tens of thousands of people who identify themselves, not tens of thousands, but a lot of people who identify themselves as national security practitioners, professionals, some variation of that. And I think it is, you know, regardless of that, it is true that there are many people who work in the field of national security, and they have clearances, and, you know, you can work either in government formally or contracting, various options. But I think the more I was kind of dug into Nitze, I really came to this view that at the, you know, he, well, okay, let me back up a little bit in his life story. He, in the 1930s, is working on Wall Street. He is successful during the Great Depression when many people are not. He is not outlandishly rich, though his main fortune, the great luck for him, well, three things. One, he marries the daughter of an heiress to a Standard Oil fortune. His sister's husband is Walter Pepke, and together they later invest in the land that is bought in Aspen, Colorado. And in the 1930s, as a sort of side hustle, he invests in a pharmaceutical company that's later acquired by Revlon. So these things are all kind of important for the rest of his life, but you know, he's semi-successful in the 1930s in his day job as a banker when most people are not. He follows James Forrestal to Washington to be involved in the preparation for the US entering World War II. And then throughout World War II, he has a number of interesting administrative jobs. He's only once really in some physical peril when he goes to Europe for the strategic bombing survey. But I think very importantly, you know, we think about the so-called wise men, people who were in banking or law firms who served the government in World War II and then oftentimes went back to their previous firms. And NHTSA made a conscious choice to stay in Washington at the end of 1945. And is offered a position back in New York, and he decides to stay, and he never really leaves. And you know, it's at a moment where if you were the State Department and you were a Foreign Service officer, you had an onward assignment. If you were in the military, you know, you could continue to rise in the ranks or choose to retire. And even with the creation of the National Security Act, or the National Security Establishment with the National Security Act of 1947, there's no kind of class of profession to accompany that. And here is where, you know, I would say that Paul NHTSA as a generalist, as a technocrat, really carves out a role that's, you know, based on the skills that he acquired in World War II, the confidence that he held from in the 1930s, you know, being in front of boards on Wall Street and testifying in front of Congress. He had a lot of confidence kind of telling people in high positions what they should do. And, you know, then, and he never, you know, it's, he never went back to a kind of normal profession. So anyway, that's a long-winded answer. We can keep, you know.
Before I turn it over to Elliot, because this, I think, is relevant to some other characteristics that NHTSA exhibited that you chronicle in the book. I once was sitting with George Shultz and Don Regan when he was chief of staff at the White House, and he was talking to a career professional, and he said to that person, he said, "The difference between you and me is that I have FUM and you don't." And the person said, "What's FUM?" And he said, "It's fuck you money. I don't need this job."
Oh, NHTSA said that.
No. This was Regan.
Oh, Regan who said that. Yeah. How they found Don Regan, whoever came up with the idea of putting him in charge there, I don't know.
that's a story for another day. Elliot, over to you.
So this is really, James already knows this, but I'm going to, for the benefit of our listeners, say, so I have a NHTSA connection. It's not just that I spent 34 years at a school which was named after him fairly late in the game, as you discuss, but which he co-founded. But at one point, I was supposed to write an authorized biography, and I pulled out of it because the things that I found pretty early on in the project, I thought it wouldn't be good, frankly, for the school if a professor there was to polish it. So I'm just going to put all this out on the table. None of this in any way detracts from this book, which is, I think, a terrific book. And in some ways, it opens up questions to ask. There are really two sides to it. One is I came to realize his account and his memoir, particularly of his early years, is really problematic. So, for example, one thing which he doesn't mention, this I think was just typical of the time. There's a lot of casual anti-Semitism. I went through his car. I got access to his correspondence. If you look at the correspondence in the 30s, there's just a lot of casual anti-Semitism. This was not unusual on Wall Street. There was more of an edge, I would say, than might be the norm, but it was definitely there. What was particularly disturbing to me, though, was during his travels to Germany in the 30s, he's writing back letters to his mother, who by the way, recommended that he read Mein Kampf. And she gave it a glowing review. And he thought the place was great. And so I came away not really trusting his retrospective account of how he felt about Nazi Germany. And I even came away thinking that it affected his views of the strategic bombing survey, where I think he went in believing that the bombing of – it was a terrible thing to bomb German cities. And the way that the survey was executed, although in some ways it's a remarkable effort and the data there is that they assembled is fantastic – in other ways, it misled historians of air power for quite a while about what the actual impact of strategic bombing was. The other thing, which in some ways I found, I couldn't write a biography that skipped over that, but I didn't really particularly want to publish it while I was there. The thing that I found fascinating about him, though, is here's this extraordinarily accomplished man. And you do touch on this, James, in the book in a number of ways, who is very insecure, who always wanted to be kind of a great foreign policy thinker. And you mentioned this, and he never really pulls it off. You know, he has an idea for a book. The book doesn't really amount to much. No, nobody's going to read. Nobody reads Paul Nitzan now. They're not going to read him in 20 years. We were talking before the show, you know, his official portrait at Seiss, the school that he helped found in 43, which is amazing. He and Christian Herter, these young guys, say we need a school to train the next generation, which I think is a remarkable achievement. It's a portrait of him in Harvard doctoral robes. Now, he got an honorary doctorate from Harvard, but he never got a PhD there. And I think it reflected, and, you know, and it's hanging up in the school that he founded, which is part of Johns Hopkins, not Harvard. It tells you something. I also felt more broadly, and I think, and again, I think this comes out a bit in the book, is this is a guy who was frequently very frustrated in his drive for power and for relevance. He never became a cabinet secretary. I think that's something we should talk about, why that's the case. He desperately wanted to be. His animus to Henry Kissinger, which was palpable even when I knew him. There are reasons why people ask questions about Kissinger and some people didn't care for him, but I thought it was a bit much. So I think, you know, part of what makes this such an interesting book is on top of the substance, which we will talk about. It's the problem. What is it like to be a really high level technocrat? Which you tend to think of as sort of bloodless and antiseptic. But the truth is, there are all kinds of emotions roiling away there as well. And even though you're absolutely right, the money cushioned all that and considerable financial success. I mean, developing Aspen, for goodness sakes. But still, it was a life story which had its share of frustration. I'll say just one thing. And again, you touch on this in the book, and I give you a lot of credit for it. He personally interviewed Albert Speer at the end of the war. And even his colleagues were saying, you know, you're really very chummy with this guy, and he's not a good guy. And as we know now, Speer was a very bad guy, actually. Speer was, we have a much, much better sense of the extent to which he was up to his neck in slave labor and all that sort of stuff. But this, you just had a sense of, he didn't particularly care about any of that stuff.
Can I respond? So on the last point, and then I'll speak to the anti-Semitism and then come back to the insecurity. Yeah, on the Albert Speer point, the editor in like 1985, 86 tried to get him to tone it down, saying, you know, I don't understand. It makes you come across like you were absorbed by him. Can you shorten this, tone it down? Nitzan got very defensive on that, saying that, you know, well, that's how I found him to be a very smart man. And me, as you know, James, kind of thinking through that, I think yes, he was entranced by him, and it is sort of the dark side of the technocratic soul during that period, which is that all he wanted to talk to him about with a kind of you know, with a sort of glee, is how he overcame bureaucratic obstacles at the same time Nietzsche did. And there's something very chilling about that. And it's very important, you know, not to think of that as normal and healthy. That's something that in terms of his, I mean, fortunately for him, he had other mentors, some at the time, and then, and keep in mind that his first kind of person that he thought about was this mover and shaker was Clarence Dillon, and because he exercised power in front of him, he picked up the phone and he told people to do things, and they did. And so, you know, I would say that over time, being around George Marshall and others leading up through George Shultz, you know, had a positive impact on him. But I certainly can't disagree with you, Professor Cohen, that there is something really kind of disturbing about his entrancement at Speer. Now, with respect to the anti-Semitism, you know, so you and I talked about this. You told me, I think, some of these things years ago, and so I looked. I mean, I looked and I thought, and I certainly, you know, wrestled with how to get at this. And so the book, I mean, it's a political biography. It's focused on the career, and at a certain point, I made a sort of conscious choice that there were going to be things. And this sounds like I'm leading up to a whitewash, but let me just sort of just say that some of the family things I didn't know how to get into. And the most kind of pressing one is what I found in the FBI file on him. Some of your listeners may not know that, you know, through the mom, Nitza had a familial connection to the Black Tom affair, which is, you know, probably the largest act of domestic terrorism against the United States for a long time. And
during World War One,
during World War, the island off of New York City. And, you know, and part of, he had a relation who was basically a German agent in Baltimore. And because of that, when he comes down to Washington the first time, he's not given a formal security clearance. He quite illegally is paid by Dylan Reed. And I think it's Nelson Rockefeller who kind of is charged with kind of looking into him. And so there's an FBI file on Nitza that gets added to then the 1940s as he kind of goes on for other positions. And the portions about his mom are really quite awful. And so sort of, it's, I mean, more, the mom is more than casual anti-Semitism, you know, that was, you know, pervasive in government. But I mean, it's, and I didn't really know how to, since it was not, I found at that point, it would be directly relevant. But you know, there are, I also did find what I thought were other sides of the equation in terms of some of his visitations to Europe, in seeing friends that had been, you know, that had been harmed by the Nazis. And that's, it's still outside of, you know, what did he think about or care about the plight, the ramifications for the Jews of Europe. It was not something that was on his mind. And there's another, I mean, and there's another, well, I can move on to the, hang on to the security, the insecurities in a second, but I do want to say that there's one portion of his life that, or a moment that's, it's a so-called dinner party in New York in, I don't know, 37 or 38, where he allegedly said that, you know, a world under British, or it was a proposition of would a world being dominated by the British, would it be better or worse than a world being dominated by the Germans? And I try to make the point in the book that if he indeed said, he as a profound, as an avowed America firster at that point, if he said that it would be no worse off to have a world dominated by the British, that just comported with his this kind of obsession with his argumentative nature and his kind of putting forth these propositions, sometimes to provoke and then sometimes to kind of take it to the extreme. But I, you know, I can't, I, yeah, he was, I'm sure, casually anti-Semitic at yeah. least. I will say
I mean, that I don't think it was a distinguished, you know, I don't think it dominated him. He was the patron to people like Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle. So he, particularly later in his career, and so I think he, I mean, I think there were traces of it that were still there all the way through. But I don't think it was the dominant feature of his personality.
But that conversation, but that conversation that James just referenced in the book, you make clear, James, that that was one of the, that was reported. And that was one of the things that held up his security clearance for quite a while. There was a question about his loyalty.
And he wasn't a teenager when he said that either. You know,
I mean, he wasn't. No, but I don't think that that was a. I don't know if that was a pro. If he meant that as a pro-Nazi thing, I think it's. I don't think it's so cut and dry. It was
talk
a dumb thing to say.
I mean,
it was a dumb thing to say. But
talk about the insecurities. I want to hear you on that.
So Henry Kissinger really hovers over him, and you know, in a kind of sometimes amusing and delightful way to see this, that in the mid 1950s, you know, Kissinger comes along, and he does many of the things that NHTSA wanted to do, but he does them better. NHTSA had been involved in a Council on Foreign Relations study group on the role of nuclear weapons in world affairs. And it was that group where Kissinger was the rapporteur that leads to the publication of his first, his sort of breakthrough book. And NHTSA writes a draft of a scathing review, and Kissinger threatens to sue him. Now, here's the story that I think kind of comes out that distinguishes the two of them. The next time, so Kissinger gets NHTSA to tone down the review, and it's all a little strange. But when they encounter each other the next time, Kissinger goes up to him, and I won't do the accent, but I mean, he says, you know, part of the deal was that I would be given unlimited space to respond to your criticism. And Kissinger says, I got to page 170 of my response. And I decided, you know, it's just not, it's not worth it. I mean, and that moment, that kind of the disarming humor was something that NHTSA, he lacked. He just didn't have it. And there were other things. I mean, nothing was stopping NHTSA from writing his own book about nuclear weapons and world affairs. They both were critics of Eisenhower. And so he didn't have the sense of humor. He didn't have the ability with words. Whatever you think of Henry Kissinger, he was genuinely funny and was a master of words. And so then they continue their association or encounters with each other in 1961, 62, when, you know, NHTSA is working in the Kennedy administration, thinking very hard about Berlin. Kissinger is kind of involved on the periphery as a consultant. And then, you know, 8 years later, they kind of switch, that one has leapfrogged the other. And that also understandably must have been a frustrating experience to endure, that somebody who had been sort of NHTSA had regarded as the junior is now very much the senior under the Nixon administration.
But James, you make another very important point, I think, about Henry and NHTSA, which is NHTSA starts out kind of writing a grand strategy for the Cold War, essentially, or at least one of the most important grand strategy documents of the Cold War, which is NSC 68, that he's charged to write after the Soviets test a nuclear weapon in 1949. He writes it in the spring of 1950. It advocates a huge defense buildup, both conventional and nuclear. It runs into all sorts of bureaucratic obstacles that you discuss in the book, and then obviously gets implemented after the North Koreans invade South Korea in June of 1950. And the United States triples the defense budget, ends up spending, 16% of GDP in 1 year on defense. And that document in many ways, although it's modified a little bit by the Eisenhower administration, it remains really kind of a very compelling document, historically down through the ages. You even talk about how after 9/11, a lot of people in the Bush administration recurred to NSC 68, talked about it. Over time, NHTSA narrows his focus. I mean, he's in the Kennedy administration. He's Assistant Secretary for International Security Affairs, essentially the equivalent of the job I later had.
Yeah, the job you had, yeah.
Right. He's offered the job of undersecretary when it's created in the mid-70s. But he chooses to sort of narrow his focus essentially really to nuclear strategy exclusively, while Henry, who starts really with the nuclear strategy piece, ends up becoming a much more broad, gauged national security professional. Can you comment on that a little?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question.
So I think to me that my sense of it has to do with the immediate aftermath and of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the kind of a differing interpretation of why it ended the way it did. Now, NHTSA spends a year or two as Secretary of the Navy and is so not in the position, so the undersecretary or assistant secretary at the time, but he was not so close to McNamara in planning as he would have liked to have been. And McNamara, I think, or at least NHTSA thought, but I think too, had the interpretation of the Cuban Missile Crisis that sort of both sides had gone to the brink. They had seen what's on the other side, or over the cliff, whatever, and knew that we're not going to do this again. And NHTSA's view was quite different. It was that he actually was quite critical of JFK during the Cuban Missile Crisis and thought that it took Dean Acheson coming into the equation to kind of set people straight. And his view was basically the Soviets had backed down because of U.S. Strategic and conventional superiority, both of which he believed were waning. And that the lesson of it was that you needed to preserve and restore American strength, not unilaterally cap the Minuteman forces at 1,000, which is what McNamara wanted. And so then on top of that, once you get into the era of multiple independent reentry vehicles and strategic defenses, although I think NHTSA thought, and I believe myself, that MIRVs are sort of even more make things even more complicated. To get into that era, and the realization of the Soviet threat after the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is you're never going to do this again to us again. You'll never do this to us again. Meaning we will catch and surpass in some areas.
It's what Deputy Foreign Minister Kuznetsov says right. to John McCloy.
Right. So by the early 70s, he. NHTSA is singularly focused on how do we restore American strength, or at least figure out a way of achieving some kind of strategic stability. Whereas, as you say, Kissinger is involved in everything. NHTSA aspired to be Secretary of Defense in a Democratic administration. After 1976, and he certainly was a contender for Jimmy Carter up until they had a very disastrous meeting in the summer of 1976. But I should also preface that, when I say in the book it's about national security, it's obviously not the only part of component of U.S. national security in the 70s and 80s. It's NHTSA's interpretation of it. And he also, I think, makes a choice in the mid-60s to focus on bilateral strategic nuclear competition as opposed to nonproliferation, which, you know, is arguably as important. But, you know, I think that, again, I think it really just comes down to the legacy in his own mind of the Cuban Missile Crisis that kind of narrows his focus.
It's a very different take than, say, McGeorge Bundy has or other people who went through that XCOM process with Kennedy. It's very different. And NHTSA really stands out in that group, both because when Kennedy muses about exchanging the missiles in Turkey and Italy for the Soviet missiles in Cuba, NHTSA is adamant that if he does that, it'll unravel NATO and that it'll be a strategic disaster for the United States. He contradicts his own boss in front of Kennedy, Robert McNamara. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about the McNamara-NHTSA relationship, because that also struck me as an odd one in the sense that, in a way, they're very similar, very, very technocratic, very focused on, you know, quantitative measurements of things that sometimes are more qualitative than they are quantitative. And yet they didn't really get along, despite the sort of similarities of approach.
Well, he, as you probably know, that in the early phone call in 1961, he was offered three positions by Kennedy, Undersecretary for Economic Affairs at the State Department, National Security Advisor, and Deputy Secretary of Defense. He turns down National Security Advisor because he doesn't think it was an important job. He thinks he's already had the econ job at State. And sort of, he then later learns that McNamara wants to have his own deputy secretary. So they didn't get off on the right foot. And, you know, McNamara was a difficult person to work for. I don't get the sense that it was that terrible at the start for the first 2 years. I mean, he does say that he went into the hospital at least once, NHTSA that is, and the real problem was McNamara, and by all accounts was a, you know, very difficult person to work for. But I think the silver lining, and it speaks to what you say, the Cuban Missile Crisis, he contradicts his own boss in front of the president. He does that as well in the fall of 1961 in the context of the Berlin Crisis. And, you know, I've not been in these rooms, both of you have, these situations, but in my reading it, I don't know whether it's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think that both were in the context of he was stepping in and saying, there's a kind of refreshing quality to that, that he's not just going to support his principal. But I have to, I said because we were talking in the green room about the, you know, the personalities, and I'll note that JFK, whatever you think of him and however you think he performed the Cuban Missile Crisis, he was unbelievably polite. I mean, if you listen to these recordings, unbelievably unfazed and polite. The only time that he really comes close to losing his temper is at Paul Nitzer. So, I mean, and that I think is kind of worthwhile in sort of thinking about the broader. My part of the reason I wrote this book and what I hope some people will take out of it is that, you know, it's easy to go in and write a policy statement. Well, not that easy, but it's doable to write something and then you leave government and say, well, I figured it all out. You guys just messed it all up. And, you know, NHTSA has the endurance to keep at it, and, you know, he's has the financial cushion, but he has the endurance to keep at it. But there are some parts of the personality that I think are worth considering in high regard, which is that he's constantly passed over, and he's sometimes willing to take demotions to work on the matters he did. He had been the Deputy Secretary of Defense, and then he, you know, has this kind of rinky-dink job on the arms control negotiations that is effectively a demotion, but he's willing to do it. But on the other hand, you know, the model And he doesn't have the capacity that Kissinger has for ass kissing and flattery. But, you know, this doesn't have to be wholly one or the other. You can kind of, you can think about the portions, the Kissinger's personality, the sense of humor and the wordsmanship. And you can think about Nietzsche's kind of unwavering kind of focus on specific things. And you can apply that to your how you proceed.
So I think, you know, one thing that I remember being very struck by, I think this was probably while I was still at Harvard, he came by and gave a talk. This is as he was about to go off to do the INF things. And I was thinking to myself, wow, this seems to be kind of at odds with everything I thought he stood for. And, you know, then there was a dinner. I was a junior faculty member, but I got invited along to sit at the foot of the table. And the sense I got was of a very, I mean, ambition is may not be quite the right word, but this is a guy who very much wanted to be in the game throughout his life. In that respect, very like Kissinger. I mean, Kissinger wanted to be in the game throughout his life. And even when it was clear that he wasn't going to have another big government job, he was going to be writing op-eds. Nietzsche was writing op-eds virtually, or he had assistants who were writing op-eds with his name on it up to the very end. So I think there was this intense desire to shape policy, which, you know, there are pros and cons with that. One thing I wanted to mention, because you talk about it in the book, you could say more. He does get very narrowly focused on nuclear weapons. I think this is also partly because this is ground on which he is very, very secure, having been involved in this, you know, really from the get-go. There is this rather large war while he's in the Defense Department, which is really quite consequential for the United States, namely the Vietnam War. There are all kinds of conventional force issues in Europe. And, you know, then there's afterwards, there's a whole, the precision guided weapons revolution and all that stuff. And he just doesn't play. I mean, he's just silent. And it's, you know, for somebody who is the consummate national security professional, well, the nukes are important. I will, and certainly in the presence of Eric Edelman, I will always insist that nuclear weapons are very important. But this other stuff is really important too. And there's very little of a track record, I think, either in government or out of government. You can tell me if you think that's too harsh. No, but in any case, to the extent you could, if you could sort of explain some of that.
Yeah, I don't think that he had any particular interest in that in the 70s and 80s. I mean, he was singularly, so why was he focused on scuttling SALT II? Well, he thought that you know, getting a bad deal would kind of lull Americans into a sense of security that the nuclear arms race was over. We didn't have to spend money on these things anymore. And I don't think that that kind of so-called logic chain in his head, it didn't contain the variables of kind of what a lot of people at the Pentagon, or some people at the Pentagon during the Carter administration and then beyond were thinking about in terms of, as you say, precision guided missiles. It just, I don't find any real evidence that he's thinking through those matters. He's obsessed with throw weights and hard kill capability, all these terms that I can tell excite Ambassador Edelman.
But it's for instance, very interesting. You know, I was looking for it in the book.
Yeah.
He's actually very critical about the B-2 bomber, in part because of this obsessive focus on, as you were saying, throw weight and the ballistic missile balance.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that, you know, Andy Marshall was advocating it in part because it was a way of forcing the Soviets to spend, you know, their limited defense resources on defenses that would basically not be as dangerous and as problematic for U.S. national security as the missiles. And, you know, Andy's view was, if they're spending more on, you know, air and missile defense, they're going to be spending less on these offensive, you know, ballistic missiles. But you don't see any trace of that in Nietzsche's thinking, really.
I don't see that. And I know that by the end, he writes this kind of pouty letter to Schultz in the end of 1988. And, you know, he even mentions that his kind of disfavor for the B2 bomber, which was already, you know, well, at that point, we were only going to fund a small fraction of what we anticipated. But I guess if I could kind of ask a question to you, or just kind of throw it out there, one of the things he says in 1987, I'm trying to remember whether you're in the room. I'm not sure you're in the room, Eric. You may have been in Moscow at the time. So there's this meeting of the former policy planning directors for the 40th anniversary of the office. And so he's there, and he just keeps saying that the Soviets, unquestionably the Soviets have strategic superiority to us. And it's almost as if he had just been reading the Paul Kennedy book, and so he's just in a very dour mood. But even then, in 1990, 91, he's still kind of saying and writing this. And I'm just kind of curious, like, what you think about that?
Well, it's a kind of interesting question. You know, you talk about, you know, another one of my former bosses, Strobe Talbot's, you know, several books on Nietzsche. I mean, he wrote, he wrote Endgame, which was a kind of TikTok journalist account of the SALT II talks during the Ford and Carter administrations. He then writes Deadly Gambits, which, you know, came out when I was working actually, I think I just left Schultz's office and had gone down to the Soviet desk.
Yeah, it's like in 84, I think.
Yeah, that was in 84. And the book, I mean, the book came out and it was sort of politically inconvenient because it highlighted, again, it was a TikTok that highlighted, you know, in particular, the two Richards, the kind of internecine bureaucratic warfare between Richard Burt and Richard Perle over the INF deployments and the negotiations of the INF treaty. But really, Nietzsche is the sort of hero of that book because he takes the famous walk in the woods with Yuli Fitsinsky, mm-hmm. his Soviet counterpart. They try to come up with a negotiated solution. Yet Nietzsche is very hostile to the book, very angry about it, as you recount. I remember working for George Schultz when Strobe came in to interview him, and they had a stenographer in there because Schultz wanted to make sure that everything was recorded very accurately. But I know it took Schultz aback that Strobe had such good access that he was saying stuff like, on such and such a date, Richard Burt sent you a memo saying X, Y, and Z. And Schultz was like, oh, my God. And then Strobe writes his final book on Nietzsche, which comes out right at the tail end of Reagan, which is Master of the Game, which, in fact, is for the most part quite flattering, maybe too flattering to Nietzsche and his role. In all of this, but does make a point, which, and I'd be curious, James, in your view of this, because you talk about it, but you don't really kind of opine on it, which is, Strobe's accusation against Nietzsche is that he is so churlish that when he's out of government, he basically opposes positions that he either had taken in government or that he would take in the future and would support. And it's really more out of kind of, peevishness about being, personal grievance or being passed over or whatnot. And I'm just curious whether you see it that way as well.
There's certainly, he felt a considerable grievance to the Eisenhower people. He had been promised, been given the job of ISA by Dulles and Eisenhower. And he set up shop there in the spring of 1953, and then it was after the nomination of Ambassador Bolin to Russia, the Republicans said no more Democrats, and so they or no more Truman folks, right? And so they took it away from him. He was apoplectic about that, and so he went out, he criticized Eisenhower, similar things with Carter, and then similar things with Bush 41. He obviously we didn't like Strobe's categorization of him as somebody who did only that. And I think it's not, you know, entirely fair to say he just opposed things out of government. I think there was a consistency there in or out of government, and that was can goes all the way back to when he's working on the Pacific Theater Report in 1946. You know, he takes the mandate for the Strategic Bombing Survey in Japan, and he kind of expands it to focus on why did they attack us in the first place? And he said it's because they thought we were too weak to respond. They were not deterred by us. And he's frustrated then that he's annoyed and insecure that he feels that George Kennan, that he had already written these things. And then Kennan writes his long telegram, which in better prose kind of lays out some of the same things. So I think, you know, so number one, I make the point in the book, I try to at least, that I think it's unfair to say he just flips and flops. I think that there's a consistency, whether or not you agree with the consistency. The thing that I'm trying to, that I still kind of weighs on me a bit, and I've just been, you know, reading through some of your report on the defense strategy, is that, you know, very much hovering over all of us, I think today is the example of the, however you want to call it, second offset, Reagan buildup in the late 70s and 1980s. And from my perspective, I know Professor Cohen has to leave in a minute. I mean, from my perspective, I get to the period of 1988 in working on this project and working on these Bruce volumes. And I see not only NHTSA, but, you know, some of the generals saying that, you know, we're at this point now and there's still so much left to be done. And so that just sort of sticks out to me that, you know, is it really so contrary? But I know Professor Cohen has a question.
So, well, it's really more of a comment. I mean, it's not so, I don't entirely disagree with you, but from that and from other things, there was a bit of a vindictive streak in him. And he could be generous, but he also had that. And so I wouldn't entirely discount the role of Peake. The main thing I want to say, because we are running out of time, and I think your book does a very good job of showing this. There's many ways in which he's a very complex and contradictory and even somewhat opaque kind of person. So, you know, I mentioned earlier, obviously I have a direct connection here. You know, this business of creating a school to train young Americans for careers in international affairs, you know, knowing in 43 that it's going to be a completely different world, that was a bold act that he and Christian Herter engaged in. And it was vision. And he was generous in supporting it. Basically, you know, the school was living hand to mouth for a long time, and he would write a check at the end of the year to make the books balance. You know, we talked that sort of anti-Semitic streak that was there, but, you know, he also you know, helped bring along people like Paul Wolfowitz, who's obviously Jewish. So I, you know, there's this very considerable sophistication about nuclear weapons, but then a certain kind of indifference to other aspects. I think he's a very complex figure, and I just want to say I think the book does a, even though it's not focused so much on the personal side, and there are, you know, there's personal tragedies there as well that we don't have to go into, that he actually reacts, I think, quite well to. Within his family, you know, this is somebody who I think will always be interesting as a certain type, but who will always, in some ways, be a little bit beyond our ability to fully understand.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would just close out by saying, you know, we could probably go on for several hours. I mean, this was someone who, you know, wrote one of the foundational or presided over the drafting of one of the foundational national security documents of the post-Cold War era, who wrote one of the, was a part, again, part of the team in after Sputnik, that wrote a major report about, you know, the future of deterrence in an age of intercontinental ballistic missiles, who, you know, was through the Berlin and Cuban crises, who helped negotiate the ABM treaty and then helped set the table for the negotiation of both START 1 and START 2. And I guess I would
finish by saying his great fear, as you document in detail, James, is that shifts in the strategic balance would lead American leaders to be self-deterred by the prospect of a nuclear exchange. And I think over the last 2 years, although it's a completely different context, but as we look, you know, towards a future where we're going to have two nuclear peers, not just one, those concerns are perhaps as apposite now as they ever were. And in that sense, this book, which goes into great detail about Nitz's thinking, is a huge public service at a important time. Yeah. So thank you very much for writing the book.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.